Accession number 4423, reel number 5.
Colonel Lewis, reel 5. What do the words Saul Howd mean, then?
Well, Saul, S-A-U-L, was the name given to this area, and Howd means a waterless desert. And a plateau, a large, flat, rather featureless area with very limited wells, water from wells. It was a feature of Somaliland, these so-called Howds. Dry, you find grass growing there and so on after the rains. Lovely grass. But in the dry season, nothing. And just, I would suggest, a small desert, but not sand, not flying sand. It was, there were a certain amount of vegetation holding the sand down. But of course, in the Karif, in the, when the monsoon winds were blowing, it would bring up a good deal of sand, especially if you disturbed it. You could live in a kind of perpetual sandstorm there if you camped anywhere around in the dry season.
So you never got a reprimand for this incident?
No, everybody accepted it is very good news indeed. It was certainly connected with the Mullah operations. It was in the area where the Mullah operated, and here we were demonstrating that the Camel Corps had authority in this area, very far away, and that a waterless desert couldn't keep it out, that the Camel Corps would go in.
Were there any other major operations you were involved in Somaliland, Colonel Lewis?
No, I think that particular expedition was the biggest. But there were a number of very small operations that I can hardly recall now in detail against tribes perhaps that had not discharged their duties towards the ruling of the district commissioners. For instance, if a tribe was told to pay so many camels over to another because some men had been killed to close the account, and this tribe hesitated or refused to do so, then the Camel Corps, if the operation was too big for the police, the Camel Corps would go out and recover the camels and bring them in, and the district commissioner could then hand them over to the claimants and bring the matter to an end that way. There were several of those. They were rather frequent difficulties, and very often the threat of the Camel Corps coming would be sufficient to urge the recalcitrant tribe to settle the matter.
Did you have to work closely with the police?
I don't think the police were dismounted. You see, they couldn't move with us. No, I don't think the police, we were involved in the petty crimes of the community. We were more involved in the intertribal disputes, perhaps, who were being investigated by the district commissioner. The police officers were looking after their police posts and so on, but they were not mobile, you see. They couldn't compete with us, with the Camel Corps moving about all over the place. It was bewildering.
I think you told me earlier on that one of the big problems which the British authorities had in Somaliland was the fact that the civilian population was armed to the teeth, and what was to be done about that?
Yes, I wouldn't say armed to the teeth. The tribes owned, a number of them were armed, and sometimes these arms were hidden even, ready in case of a raid or emergency. they took the view that they must defend themselves against, if they were on the Abyssinian frontier, against the Burads or something of that sort. Or if they quarreled with a tribe, well, if they had more rifles, they felt they had more power. The rifles and the horses, the ponies, went together. They made them rather feel rather strong as a tribe. And therefore, they were very reluctant to give these up. Some of the arms were very old, and I should think more dangerous to the firer than to the target. But others were not at all bad. They were magazine rifles, difficulty perhaps of ammunition. But as long as they had these rifles, you see, they constituted a risk beyond the powers of the police, really, to cope with. And a tribe could amass a number of men, an all, as they called it, a small army, and go on the rampage. And if, by chance, they amalgamated, of course, then it could become a threat to the government, to the good government of the country. The Somalis, these rifles, to them, gave them a prestige amongst their own people. They, rather like the Arabs, they like walking about with a rifle. And it was a very sensitive question. It had led to trouble nearly every time the government hinted that they thought it was time they were disarmed. There was trouble, and they had to give up this, the government had to give up this ambition, this hope to improve law and order in the country. They had to abandon this. It was a sensitive question.
Could you comment on the effect on social life for the Europeans in Somaliland of the continuing changeover of military personnel coming in into the Somaliland Camel Corps?
The Camel Corps officers did, say, 5 years in three tours, perhaps. And some came back for a second innings later on. But generally speaking, most of the people in serving in the Camel Corps had come from many parts of the world. Some from England, some had been in India recently, some had been in the West Indies recently, some had been in Hong Kong recently, and so on. Therefore, they provided an element of that was not to be found in Somaliland, because most of the officials in Somaliland, once there, stayed there for the because of the peculiarities of the country, the being fanatical Muslims. Swahili was not the sort of lingua franca up there at all, and I think they could come. The officials could have come rather, very parochial. I think there was a risk of that. Too Somalized, with this constant flow of people, fresh blood from outside, I think it had a good effect on the stabilized officials, the permanent officials of the country. They met people who'd seen, been serving in other places and other spheres. Yes, I think the Camel Corps certainly helped the sort of social complex in that way.
Were there any interesting industries in Somaliland?
There were no industries as we know them here in outside Somaliland. The sheepskins were very valuable, and therefore the country was very sensitive to any kind of animal disease, such as anthrax. It could destroy one of the basic industries. The sheepskins were found to be very suitable for making first-class gloves in England, and a great many sheepskins of a regular trade, sending these skins to dents, for instance, in England, who had a contract with the Somaliland government, I think, to use these skins. They were found very suitable for high-grade leather gloves. That was one thing. The ships would take these skins home to Aden, take the skins and sheep to Aden, and of course they brought back camels very often, and there was this kind of industry. They were thinking of going in for agriculture, and certain areas were selected for experiments. The government was running some kind of farm to grow maize, but it was a very uphill battle against the prejudice of the Somalis, who were primarily keen on their camels. For instance, I remember hearing of a conference somewhere near Barao, where a colonial office official came out to try and lecture the Somalis, through interpreters, of course, on the advantages of this particular area for crop growing. And the Somalis said they were very interested in hearing what he'd got to say, but they'd like to think it over and come back in the morning and tell him what they thought, you see. Well, they came back in the morning, and the district commissioner noticed that they were the mullahs, people were sitting in the front. And before very long, one of them got up and said, "Well, we're very interested in this gentleman who's come from London and telling us how to live our lives. But Allah has looked after us for centuries, and we do very well with him. We understand him, and he understands us. We don't want to hear any more from your friend from London."
I think that you're very proud of the tradition of the Somaliland Camel Corps as far as the award of VCs was concerned in the pre-First World War period.
Yes, there were more VCs, so it is said, and in Somaliland, not necessarily by the Camel Corps, but there were expeditions there with Indian troops and British troops against the Mad Mullah, and it is said that there were more VCs and in Somaliland than in any other sphere up to the outbreak, of course, of the First War.
What did you think of the Mad Mullah yourself? Was he still alive when you went there, when you went to Somaliland?
Yes. The Air Force had endeavoured to bomb Tully Fort, and had actually done so, but the mullah had got news of this possibility, and he had decimated his own forces. He became fanatic, more fanatical than ever. And if anybody disagreed with him, any of his tribal leaders disagreed with him, they were promptly executed. And there were places around Tully Fort where one was told that so many of this tribe or that tribe were executed by orders of the mullah. And so when the final attack in 1921 came by the Royal Air Force, and the ground forces were moving behind the secondary role, he had escaped into Abyssinia with his entourage, and he was not turned out there. He remained there and died of flu some years afterwards. Abdullah Hassan was presumably an Arab because he knew something about building the Somalis. Well, he knew quite a lot, the Somalis, and he must have brought Arabs with him to build this enormous fort. I mean, the fort at Tully could hold, well, I suppose in the courtyard, in the middle of it, could take 1,000 men. And there was water in there and all the rest of it, enough to hold out. And it was the only thing of its kind in the whole of Somaliland. Nobody else had built anything, you see. So this was an extraordinary man, and he was a conceited, vain person who used to send rude messages to the British government of what he was going to do with them. And he became quite merciless in the end when adversity came towards him. He began slaughtering his own people, you see. And in the end, as I say, the small party went to Abyssinia where they died.
I think you said that you heard of a German who worked for him.
Did I say anything?
No, we haven't put it on before.
You haven't?
No.
Yes, there was this extraordinary case of a German who lived in Djibouti. He was a mechanic, it said, or armourer. And he made a living in Djibouti, which, of course, is in under the French government colonial system. And Djibouti was becoming the main arterial road up to Djibouti. The railway was being built there, or had already been built, yes. Well, when the war came, August 1914, this German living in Djibouti found himself in a very awkward position because he was going to be interned. And he thought he must get back to Germany to fight for the fatherland. So he escaped from Djibouti, and he went up to Addis Ababa and reported himself to the German embassy. And the German ambassador, I suppose, pointed out that it would be very difficult to get him back to Germany to fight for the fatherland. And by degrees, he told him that there was a mad mullah in Somaliland who was being very effective against the British. And he had a lot of rifles and things that were needed repairing. And if he really wished to serve the fatherland, this German, the best thing to do was to go down to the headquarters of the Mad Mullah and help him with his looking after his rifles and so on. So the German agreed, very foolishly. And he went down there, and the mullah welcomed him, so he said. He started keeping a diary, this German, and wrote it very well. I don't know how he got the ink and all the rest. There were Arabs there, so they must have brought some. The mullah became very impatient with him after a bit, because he said, "Look, the British, I hear, have got machine guns, and how is it you don't know how to make one? And now I hear they've got aeroplanes. When are you going to make an aeroplane? Well, one of these things, they are. That's what we want." And this poor German found himself in a very very critical situation by degrees. And so he was always being threatened with execution. It said in his diary that the mullah would say, "Well, I'll just show you what I'm going to do to you tomorrow, what I'm going to do to you tomorrow if you don't improve your performance for us." And he would take him out and show him some sheikhs who were going to be executed for not carrying out their duties properly, you see. And when the Royal Air Force bombed Tale right at the end of the operation, The Mad Mullah went into Abyssinia, but this German managed to escape. And he went off with one askari who had been a prisoner of the mullah. He'd captured in one of the earlier operations. And they went off into the Houd, into the Saul Houd. And they died of thirst there. The German died of thirst there, but the askari got through and reported to the British authorities and had this man's diary. Now, that diary was for many years in the district commissioner's office at Burrau, and I actually saw it. But I did not realize the importance of it and the great interest that was surrounded later on. For instance, when I went back to Somaliland in 1950 as private secretary to Sir Gerald Rees, he was very interested in this and deplored the fact that the diary could not be found. Of course, in the intervening period, the Italians had been in Somaliland and driven the British out. So it's just possible that that diary is somewhere in Italy.
How did you come to join the WAF in 1931, Colonel Lewis?
I was with my regiment at Wiesbaden, Biebrich, where I think Verdi, or was it Beethoven? I can't remember, lived for some time. In 1929, and the evacuation of the German occupied of the occupied area was coming about very dramatically, and I saw ahead a return to Tidworth in England. In the meanwhile, I had become engaged. Well, I wasn't actually engaged, but I was very much in love with a girl that I'd met in Germany, that I knew before, and I hoped sometime to marry her, which I did eventually. But so I thought it would be a good idea to save some money. Secondly, I'm afraid I heard the call of Africa. They always say there is a call. It's difficult to wash it out of one's hair, so to speak. You go out there and serve a few years, you feel you would like to go back. It's very strong sometimes. And I was also, I'd played polo at Wiesbaden, and I knew it was a very growing concern in Nigeria, West Coast. So, and I was interested in the Africans. I was thinking a good deal about them in my spare time, so to speak. And I thought, well, rather than go and sit in Tidworth, go and work there with the regiment, while I'm young, I would like to go out and see other countries. So I applied for the West Africa.
Why did you pick out West Africa?
Well, I had been in the East in the Camel Corps. My wife's to be's brother was in Nigeria, and I'd become interested in northern Nigeria, particularly Kano, and the vast area of the Muslim people, too, Mohammedans there, and its long history going back. Well, I believe you can still find Crusader mail in places like Kano. I saw some with the emirs there. They were said to belong to the Crusaders. And this route right across Africa to the Middle East, somehow I thought, I'd used to the deserts, I thought I would like to see more of this sort of, countries. So I applied again, being told that there was not the slightest chance of my being sent out there for years, if ever, I was told by the clearing office. But anyway, I put my application in, and the CO backed it, and it went in. And like my journey to Somaliland, it came very dramatically. I was posted to the West Africa and Nigeria, which is the country I wanted to go, and northern Nigeria, as it happened, the 1st Battalion, Kaduna.
Had you requested to go to northern Nigeria, or was it just sheer...
No, it was very dangerous ground to say I want to go there, because they probably told you that you would have to join the West African Fighting Force wherever you were sent, and it might be the Gold Coast, it might be Sierra Leone, it might be another place, Calabar, or whatever it was. No, that's in Nigeria, southern. No, it might be Calabar in southern Nigeria. It was very dull. I would have hated them. There were no horses. In the Tsetse Fly area. And everything came right. I was posted to northern Nigeria, Kaduna, the 1st Battalion. And I must say, it was a great experience out there, but quite different from Somaliland.
In what way was it so different?
Well, it was a static unit to start with. The Camel Corps was mobile. And we were we were sort of Guards Battalion of Nigeria. I don't think the other battalions would like to hear too much about that. But we were the sort of rather showpiece, I suppose, in the capital of the northern provinces. Nigeria then was divided into two northern and southern provinces. And there were a lieutenant governor in each and a main governor over both in Lagos. And we were, you see, at the headquarters of the Lieutenant Governor of the Northern Provinces with all the ceremonial and so on. We had a guards officer commanding us, and it was a very static life. I went round to the police mutiny in Lagos, which was quite exciting, but that came later.
Were you involved in operating against that mutiny?
Yes, yes. I took down the Dakar Kerry Company. The Dakar Kerrys were a tribe whose chief appealed to the government to take some of his men. He wanted them to see more of the world. They were very localized people. They weren't allowed to leave their country. They had to be buried in their own tribal area and all this sort of thing. They weren't allowed out, according to tribal custom. The chief was more far-seeing and wanted some of his young men to join the West African Frontier Force. So the government agreed, and they recruited a special company of these people, and I commanded them. They were known as the Dakar Kerrys. They spoke no Hausa at all, so they had to learn it. The first thing to do was teaching them drill at the depot and all the rest of it. They had to learn the language as well, like the Europeans who went out there. And they all spoke it very well. They picked it up remarkably well. Africans do. They concentrate on, you see, they don't, they concentrate on one thing at a time, and they learned the language very well. And, you see, if any of them die, fortunately, during my time, none died. They're supposed to be buried in their own country. Well, it was miles away, hundreds of miles away, right out in the off the beaten tracks. So I had to send back earth from the grave in a box to be buried in their own country. They were very nice people, and once they had mastered the language, I could speak to them in Hausa, and they caused no trouble at all, and they were very keen on their work and very smart. They loved it. And they were very keen to learn more about the outside world. They were very primitive, simple people, but anxious to learn. You see, then one day, I remember, I came out of the officer's mess after dinner one night, and I saw the Lieutenant Governor talking to the Commandant of the West African Frontier Force outside the mess, and I thought it was very peculiar that he should be there in the middle late at night like this, talking to the commandant. So I went home. I was married by then. I said to my wife, I think there's something up. I've just seen the lieutenant governor talking to the commandant. Very mysterious.